Centro Nazionale per gli Esami.
Maturità 2006.
Prova d'ascolto.
A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto dell'inglese.
La prova consiste di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Ciascuna di esse presenta un testo base che ascolterete e gli esercizi ad essi collegati.
Prima leggerete gli esercizi, poi ascolterete il testo base e già durante l'ascolto potete dare la risposta. Ciascun testo base verrà proposto all'ascolto due volte e tra queste ci sarà una pausa per dare le risposte. L'inizio e la fine del testo parlato verranno segnalati dal seguente segnale acustico.
Scrivete nella prova d'esame negli appositi spazi usando la penna stilografica o la penna sfera.
Se sbagliate, cancellate la risposta e riscrivetela. Le risposte illeggibili e le correzioni non chiare si valutano con 0 punti.
Dopo aver completato ambedue le parti, la parte A e la parte B, avrete a disposizione 1 minuto di tempo per annerire con la matita sul foglio per le risposte le relative caselle dell'esercizio A.
Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Buon lavoro!
Queste erano le istruzioni generali. Ora incomincerete a risolvere la prova d'esame.
Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite il foglio d'esame.
Section A. You're going to hear a program about fussy eaters. As you listen to the recording, tick the appropriate column below and shade in the appropriate circles on your answer sheet. You will hear the recording twice. Now read through the statements.
But in a survey at University College London, nearly 20% of the children under 7 were called significantly food neophobic, which means they showed a reluctance to try new foods or they even refuse them altogether. Most pernickety eating is normal and it fades over time, but in extreme cases, children may need specialist help. For the last 10 years, a team at Great Ormond Street Hospital has worked with more than 100 families where, for a variety of reasons, mealtimes have become a battle. Rachel Schofield went to see what tactics they're using.
The hospital play specialist Mally Wynne-Stanley is in charge of entertaining today's 4 young visitors and their parents in the colourful playroom. It's packed with toys, a climbing frame, bikes, a doll's house, but the activities are to centre around all things edible.
When you think about a baby learning, when they start weaning, most babies go through their hands in the food, chuck it over their heads, chuck it everywhere. A lot of our children have been tube-fed or they've been afraid of food, so they've never been through this stage. So basically we take them right back to that stage and we make food fun. We try and take all the fear out of it, so it doesn't matter if you get your fingers in it. If sometimes I get absolutely painted with yogurt, I get everything all over me.
For many of the children referred to the feeding programme, eating is an alien concept. 5.5-year-old Lydia has been tube-fed overnight since she was 6 weeks old because of a floppy larynx and is only now learning to eat and drink normally. Her mum, Lauren, says the twice-monthly visits to Great Ormond Street are helping.
It's very strange. She panics when she has something solid in her mouth and she starts to retch and choke. So it's getting her used to the fact that, you know, putting food and having an object in your mouth is normal. She's not eating an awful lot, but she is starting to eat.
Tube feeding has other knock-on effects which are hard to overcome.
Lydia's stomach will rumble and she just will ignore it. Whereas when our stomachs rumble, we think, oh, I must go and eat something. That link between the stomach and the head is not there with her. And it's how we get around that. I mean, how do we make her understand that when your stomach rumbles, actually you are hungry?
Libby believes society's attitude as a whole to feeding our children is also at fault. She says there have been significant and unhelpful changes since she was bringing up her daughter.
There were processed foods around, but you wouldn't go to a restaurant and find a children's menu, which would be chicken nuggets and chips or fish fingers and chips. It does seem as if parents do go along with the sort of marketing ploys about that children have to eat certain types of food, which has to look a certain way or be a certain colour.
The lunch menu here is simply whatever each child can manage, be that a tin of tuna or just a lick of ice cream. There's praise for every mouthful, and at the end of the meal, it's time for a visit to the sticker books on the wall to record everyone's progress.
The children get stickers for just about everything that they do. This one in particular, she's got a sticker here for eating yoghurt and one for touching scrambled egg, for licking a kiwi fruit, for eating lots, which is probably about two chips or something.
Now you will hear the recording again.
But in a survey at University College London, nearly 20% of the children under seven were called significantly food neophobic, which means they showed a reluctance to try new foods or they even refused them altogether. Most pernickety eating is normal and it fades over time, but in extreme cases, children may need specialist help. For the last 10 years, a team at Great Ormond Street Hospital has worked with more than 100 families where, for a variety of reasons, mealtimes have become a battle. Rachel Schofield went to see what tactics they're using.
The hospital play specialist Mally Wynne-Stanley is in charge of entertaining today's four young visitors and their parents in the colourful playroom. It's packed with toys, a climbing frame, bikes, a doll's house, but the activities are to centre around all things edible.
When you think about a baby learning, when they start weaning, most babies go through their hands in the food, chuck it over their heads, chuck it everywhere. A lot of our children have been tube-fed or they've been afraid of food, so they've never been through this stage. So basically we take them right back to that stage and we make food fun. We try and take all the fear out of it, so it doesn't matter if you get your fingers in it. If sometimes I get absolutely painted with yoghurt, I get everything all over me.
For many of the children referred to the feeding programme, eating is an alien concept. 5.5-year-old Lydia has been tube-fed overnight since she was 6 weeks old because of a floppy larynx and is only now learning to eat and drink normally. Her mum, Lauren, says the twice-monthly visits to Great Ormond Street are helping.
It's very strange. She panics when she has something solid in her mouth and she starts to retch and choke. So it's getting her used to the fact that, you know, putting food and having an object in your mouth is normal. She's not eating an awful lot, but she is starting to eat.
Tube feeding has other knock-on effects which are hard to overcome.
Lydia's stomach will rumble and she just will ignore it, whereas when our stomachs rumble, we think, oh, I must go and eat something. That link between the stomach and the head is not there with her. And it's how we get around that. I mean, how do we make her understand that when your stomach rumbles, actually you are hungry?
Libby believes society's attitude as a whole to feeding our children is also at fault. She says there have been significant and unhelpful changes since she was bringing up her daughter.
There were processed foods around, but you wouldn't go to a restaurant and find a children's menu, which would be chicken nuggets and chips or fish fingers and chips. It does seem as if parents do go along with the sort of marketing ploys about that children have to eat certain types of food, which has to look a certain way or be a certain colour.
The lunch menu here is simply whatever each child can manage, be that a tin of tuna or just a lick of ice cream. There's praise for every mouthful, and at the end of the meal, it's time for a visit to the sticker books on the wall to record everyone's progress.
The children get stickers for just about everything that they do. This one in particular, she's got a sticker here for eating yoghurt and one for touching scrambled egg, for licking a kiwi fruit, for eating lots, which is probably about two chips or something.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You're going to hear Kate Moses talk about her book on Sylvia Plath. As you listen to the recording, write your answers in note form in the spaces below. You will hear the recording twice. Now read through the questions.
People have become obsessed with this story. Why did you become obsessed with it?
Well, I'm not sure that I became obsessed with it. In fact, I was initially put off from Plath when I first read her as a college student. I found her really terrifying and really wasn't interested in pursuing her. But when I was pregnant with my first child, I came across for the first time Plath's poems about motherhood, which I still think are some of the most uncanny and original evocations of the complicated emotional and psychological nature of motherhood.
But why did you want to write a fictional account? Some people have been critical and said this novel leaves you invaded. One critic said it pins the poet like a butterfly under glass, imprisoning her in her life rather than allowing her to fly through her work. Why can't the work be left as her testament? Why did you have to imagine her story?
Well, I have to say I completely disagree with that particular critic, because what this book is really about is Plath's artistic process. The thrust of this book is Plath's aerial manuscript, which has never been published as she intended it. And those poems form the basis of this fictional narrative, and they, in fact, are an evocation of the fictional mythic narrative that she created through the poems in order to tell herself a new story of her life and give herself a new way to imagine a future.
But two of the main characters in the book are her daughter and her son, both of whom are still alive. And Frieda, her daughter, has expressed a lot of anger recently. She wrote a poem called My Mother, in which she said, "My buried mother is up dug for repeat performances." And, of course, there's a film being made. Does that not make you pause for thought that you've invaded their privacy?
Well, I paused for thought immediately when I recognized the story that the aerial manuscript, that Plath's aerial manuscript presented, for those very reasons. I was not interested in causing either her children or anyone else who had known or loved Plath any additional painful experiences. But at the same time, I feel like it's very important to look closely at any artist's intentions. And in this case, Plath's intentions for her greatest work were not honored. And rather than focus on the biographical details of Plath, which I think is what Frieda Hughes in particular feels pained and frustrated by, that so many people focus on the biographical details. This is really about how her work was informed by her life.
Now you will hear the recording again.
People have become obsessed with this story. Why did you become obsessed with it?
Well, I'm not sure that I became obsessed with it. In fact, I was initially put off from Plath when I first read her as a college student. I found her really terrifying and really wasn't interested in pursuing her. But when I was pregnant with my first child, I came across for the first time Plath's poems about motherhood, which I still think are some of the most uncanny and original evocations of the complicated emotional and psychological nature of motherhood.
But why did you want to write a fictional account? Some people have been critical and said this novel leaves you invaded. One critic said it pins the poet like a butterfly under glass, imprisoning her in her life rather than allowing her to fly through her work. Why can't the work be left as her testament? Why did you have to imagine her story?
Well, I have to say I completely disagree with that particular critic, because what this book is really about is Plath's artistic process. The thrust of this book is Plath's aerial manuscript, which has never been published as she intended it. And those poems form the basis of this fictional narrative, and they in fact are an evocation of the fictional mythic narrative that she created through the poems in order to tell herself a new story of her life and give herself a new way to imagine a future.
But two of the main characters in the book are her daughter and her son, both of whom are still alive. And Frieda, her daughter, has expressed a lot of anger recently. She wrote a poem called My Mother, in which she said, "My buried mother is up dug for repeat performances." And, of course, there's a film being made. Does that not make you pause for thought that you've invaded their privacy?
Well, I paused for thought immediately when I recognized the story that the aerial manuscript, that Plath's aerial manuscript presented, for those very reasons. I was not interested in causing either her children or anyone else who had known or loved Plath any additional painful experiences. But at the same time, I feel like it's very important to look closely at any artist's intentions. And in this case, Plath's intentions for her greatest work were not honored. And rather than focus on the biographical details of Plath, which I think is what Frieda Hughes in particular feels pained and frustrated by, that so many people focus on the biographical details. This is really about how her work was informed by her life.
This is the end of section B.
Ora avete a disposizione un minuto per poter annerire con la matita sul foglio per le risposte le relative caselle in corrispondenza del quesito A.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto dell'inglese. Smettete di scrivere, chiudete il foglio d'esame e posatelo unitamente al foglio per le risposte sull'orlo del banco.
Ancora un cordiale saluto.